So Isaiah 40:21-31. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. And its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground, than he blows on them and they wither, and a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. To whom will you compare me, or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel? My way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youth grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on the wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint.
What a beautiful passage, is it not? I've always enjoyed this section in Isaiah. Well, what do you think of when you hear the word power? Most Americans, I think, probably recoil at the talk of power, at least in reference maybe to politics. And the history of our nation is what it is because of a reaction to abuses of power. Our founding documents were created in such a way as to limit power, right? The first 10 amendments of the Constitution, this thing we call the Bill of Rights, was penned in part as to protect individual liberty. All of these rights were to keep a check, say, on the threat of government abuse of power. And today, many have forgotten this, and we will speak of which party is in power or which president is in power at the moment. We use that sort of terminology, but that's not the kind of language that our founders would have used. Power was something that no single individual, or at least small group of individual, or of individuals, was worthy of possessing. It was something to be kept in check, by vesting it in the people, or it was derived from the consent of the governed, is, I think, the language that's used in the Declaration of Independence. Power in the American system, if I understand it correctly, is vested in the citizens, right? Not in the politicians or in the government. So we have this very famous quote, which y'all have probably heard, by Thomas Jefferson, which says this: when the people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. But despite our gradual move away, maybe from constitutional limits on the that were originally placed on the government, and the many Americans today who don't flinch when they hear the talk of the government growing in power and influence, most Americans, I think, still hesitate when we hear the word power. We still have a great caution that is there. And it's not just towards the government. I think it's also towards all kinds of institutions and organizations and corporations and businesses that exert maybe some kind of influence. Even the church, I think, there is maybe hesitation when we hear talk of power. At home, we have this movie that's titled The Incredibles. And maybe y'all have seen it before. It's a little children's movie. And the main sort of family is the family of the Incredibles. And there's Mr. and Miss Incredible, and they have a handful of little kids. Well, they're superheroes who have to go underground because they're being persecuted, basically, by the average people or whatever that don't have their powers, which is kind of odd. But in one scene, there's this former superhero, Mr. Incredible, who's sitting in an office in his desk, and he's this massive man. I mean, this enormous guy. And he's sitting behind a desk, and he works for an insurance company, and his name is, I guess it's maybe an alias or something, but it's Bob. And he's sitting there, and there's this old woman at in front of him, and she's weeping and crying about how she can't get help with her problem. And, of course, Bob works for the insurance company, and he's trying to explain to her the nature of her policy, and finally kind of says, you know what, all right, I'm sorry that you're dealing with this, and he helps her. He has compassion on her, and he's moved to help her and to try and do something. So he tells her about this form she can fill out to get whatever. Well, then, right around the time that she's leaving, his boss comes around the corner, and he's really upset, and he gets in Bob's face, even though his boss is this, you know, tiny little run of a man, and Bob's this massive giant. And he says, you authorize payment on such and such and such account? And Mr. Incredible says, you know, are we not supposed to help people, sir? Their policy clearly states this and that and the other thing. And the boss is like, so what? You know, it doesn't matter what their policy states. And he says, but are we not supposed to help people? Mr. Incredible replies. And he says, we're supposed to help our people, was the response of the boss, starting with our shareholders. That's what he says. But this is, even though this is a fictitious account, it really sort of reflects the mentality of a lot of businesses and even, I think, our politicians today in our government. It's not about doing what's right anymore. It's about doing what profits us and our people. The bottom line, our groups. So I think maybe this creates the suspicion, right, that we have towards power, towards our leaders, or towards maybe all of our institutions, whether it be the church or businesses or whatever. So I set that up by saying, what do we do when we come to a text like this? Us Americans who are naturally bothered by the idea of power. A passage which on the surface is all about power. It's all about God and the strength of His might. How He alone holds all final power and nothing can overcome His will. With all of our hesitation towards power and authority, what would God have us see today in this passage? What does God want to speak to us today, to us Americans? Well, I mean, there might be a bunch of things, and maybe y'all will get a little something out of this different than kind of where I want to go with it. But I think that the big thread running through this text will be that God's power is not like earthly power. God's power is very different. And there's four big ways I think we see in our passage today. There's probably a bunch of others, but four that I really felt like we could focus on and talk a little bit about this morning. And that's these. God's power, this is the first one. God's power is ultimate, not penultimate, like earthly power. So earthly powers are second to God. Behind them is God's power, which is ultimate. He can dispose of them as He will. That's the first one. The second one is this, that God's power, despite its great magnitude, can be applied precisely and carefully, unlike earthly powers. And the third one is that God's power is kept in check by God's perfect moral character, unlike earthly, corrupt earthly powers. And then the last point I hope that we'll see is that God's power is employed in behalf of the weak and the voiceless, unlike so many earthly powers that we know. Well, let's look at our first one, shall we? That God's power is ultimate. Just very straightforward. Look at verses 21 through 24, if you will. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. So on and so forth. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, do they take root in the ground, that He blows on them and they wither. The point is clear here, right? Earthly authorities are second to God. Maybe you remember when Jesus was on trial before Pilate. In John, I think it's chapter 19, Pilate says this to Jesus, because Jesus wasn't responding. He was getting frustrated with him. And Pilate's grilling him with all these questions. He's like, do you not hear these accusations that are being made against you? What do you have to say for yourself? How does Jesus respond? Pilate says this. He says first, you do not speak to me. Do you not know that I have authority to release you or to crucify you? He was getting frustrated because Jesus wouldn't answer him. Do you not know that I'm the one that can let you go? And Jesus says this, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. That's what Jesus replied with. So when evil rises up, when we're in frustrating situations or maybe we're concerned about the future or whatever it is, let us remember that the people in power are on God's watch. Even if it doesn't make sense to us why He allows them to remain there. But God will dispose of them in His perfect timing. There's much more we could say about that. But that's the first point, really straightforward. Behind all of our earthly powers lies God. God is the ultimate power. And they are there because God allows them to be, and He will do away with them as He sees fit in the right time. The second point is this. God's power can be applied precisely. So if you look at verses 25 and 26 with me. To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all of these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name. Because of His great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Here we see immeasurable power mingled with precision and accuracy. God not only created these massive balls of gas that we know as stars, which are unbelievably powerful, massively powerful, but He also numbers them, and not a single one is missing. Billions and billions of stars, God knows them all, sustained and accounted for, not a single one overlooked. One writer about this passage, one commentator says this, speaking of God, His direction is individual. The stars are like so many pet dogs called by name to take their place in their master's design. And innumerable though they are, their number is never less than complete. So God is bewilderingly powerful, but perfectly precise. On earth, you will struggle to find a government agency or a political leader or machine that combines both of these qualities, right? They lost my application, or they misplaced this or that, or you're a number on a page. They may have great power and influence, but the precision is lacking. Or sometimes we see it the other way around. Maybe they're agencies and people that are very precise, but they lack the power to have influence. God has both power and precision. Well, the third thing I want to see us to see in our passage this morning is that God's power is checked by His moral character. This sort of lines up with some of our concerns here in America, right? That power be kept in check. And we may think of this passage, maybe it's not right on the surface, but I want to try and open this up a little bit for us about how that's actually true in a way of God. Power corrupts, and history has told us that, right? Just look back. Look back at human history, and you see very, very easily that people rise to power and influence and wealth, and things go bad after that. Our founders saw this. Checks needed to be put in place and established to keep power from being abused or from running amok because of man's evil nature. Whether we believe it today or not, really that was one of the core principles, I think, that the founders had when they established our nature, that man cannot be trusted with a great deal of power. Man is easily corrupted. But unlike man, God does not have an evil nature that inclines Him to abuse power. God is very different. And though God possesses infinite power, His perfect and His holy perfect nature and perfect character requires Him to do what is right and just. God can't do otherwise. God always does what the counsel of His will tells Him to do, which is always what's right and just and perfect. Look at verses 27 and 28. I want to unpack this a little bit for you. Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is everlasting, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and His understanding no one can fathom. Well, this sort of rhetorical dialogue that Isaiah is having here with Jacob or with Israel, I think is intended to imply two things. I think this is sort of what I'm pulling out of this, is that Isaiah is telling us that, well, we're seeing that Israel is either suffering in some way or will be suffering. Maybe Isaiah is prophesying about the future, or maybe he's speaking of something in the present day. But they're suffering in this dialogue that he's having. And they're trying to come to grips with it. They're trying to understand it. Why does God not act? Why does my suffering continue? That's the question that Israel asks.
Well, the first wrong conclusion that is drawn is that God doesn't know about it. Look at verse 27. My way is hidden from the Lord. I know why my suffering continues. Well, it's because I've gotten lost in the details, right? God doesn't see me. I'm lost in that huge stack of papers on that real powerful guy's desk there. So I'm somewhere in there, but he's forgot about me. He's lost it. We assume that God is like earthly powers, like what we can understand. I promise you there will be times when you will be tempted to think that God has forgotten you. That God does not remember. You will be tempted to think that God is not hearing your prayers. That He does not care for your plight. I know I felt this way very intensely some years ago when I was dealing with what was almost debilitating anxiety in my life. I could hardly get out of bed and go to work in the morning. I was so anxious and distraught all the time. And it brings me to tears thinking about it. But there were times when I thought, God, where are you? What are you doing to me? I've got to live my life. I've got to go to work. I've got to function. And you're not hearing me. You're not helping me. Well, Israel felt this way, no doubt, when they were in Egypt. You know how long they were slaves in Egypt for? 400 years Israel was in slavery in Egypt. And no doubt Israel would feel this way again when they were taken into exile a handful of times later on. But God says this through the mouth of the prophet just a few chapters later in Isaiah 49. He says this in verses 14 and 15. Zion says, that is Israel, the people of God, the Lord has forsaken me. The Lord has forgotten me. And then God says this, can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion on the child that she's born? Though even she may forget, I will not forget you. God's care for His people and for their suffering transcends even the world's closest and best relationship, and mother nursing her newborn child. But we don't have to go to Isaiah 49. We can stay right here in Isaiah 40. And He reminds us of this truth. We've got this rhetorical discussion going on, right? He's saying Jacob is complaining, and then Isaiah answers with some rhetorical questions. In verse 28, here's what he says. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. This is Isaiah's response to their rhetorical questions about being forgotten. What's he getting at here? What's Isaiah saying with this? Well, just a few verses earlier, we just looked at this just a second ago, right? Isaiah said, lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all of these? Who brings out the starry host one by one, calls forth each of them by name because of His great power and mighty strength? Not one of them is missing. Isaiah is reminding Israel and us that our suffering may continue, but it's most definitely not because God has forgotten us or because He does not take notice. Doesn't forget the names of the stars or where they are. Isaiah doesn't assume, as maybe we're apt to assume, that because God is powerful, that means therefore you're insignificant. And that maybe He's forgotten. Or that we got lost in the mounds of paperwork. Or the gazillion other complaints that He's dealing with. All the voicemails, right, that are there on His desk. Ours is in there somewhere. God's power is not like the powers here on earth. That's not the reason. But the second thing that this rhetorical question, I think, seems to imply is that God will not do what's right. That maybe God is somehow lacking. God is not just. In the NAS version of this, the NIV has a little bit of a different wording. The NAS says this, Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God, is what it says in the NAS. Jacob, Israel, God's people at the time, says, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due to me escapes His notice. The question seems not to imply just that you're forgotten. So maybe they concede, right? Maybe in this discussion now that Israel, that Isaiah's having here with Israel, he concedes, okay, yeah, God doesn't forget. You're right. He remembers the billions and billions of stars. There's no way he's forgotten me. But that's worse. He knows my pain. He hasn't forgotten me. He sees it, and yet he doesn't act. That's worse. I almost wish that he did forget, maybe. And that could sort of get him off the hook, right? So it's not maybe just that there are poor people, say, in Vermont, or homeless people who have nothing to eat, people who have no money and resources, or people who have money and resources don't do anything about it. Maybe they have a vague understanding that somewhere out there are these poor folks and we're not going to do anything about it. It's not just that. It's the fact that you just walk right past them. A couple hundred dollars in your pocket and you walk right past them and just look the other way. It's almost like that, that's what God's doing. It's not just a vague failure to act on the suffering that you know is there, but almost a proactive choice not to do anything about it. That seems to maybe be implied here. My cause is just, and God is not doing anything to help me. How come he doesn't act? Okay, well, Mr. Isaiah, if God knows and hasn't forgotten, then why doesn't he move? God has the power to act and to change my situation, so why doesn't he? You kind of hear that almost a little bit in these verses, maybe that's there underlying this. Well, what is Isaiah's response? This is really interesting, I think. Look at the end of verse 28, the very last phrase there. His understanding no one can fathom. The NAS uses the word inscrutable. The ESV has unsearchable. Where the NIV has no one can fathom. The same idea pretty much. But think about this. Think about what's not said. Isaiah doesn't say, well, God must be unrighteous. Or God must be unjust. Nor does he say, God doesn't have control. Or God didn't do that. It's not God's fault that this or that happened. As if somebody has more power than God, and God can't do anything about it. No, this whole passage is God created the heavens and the earth. Everything is controlled by God, down to the smallest atom. Everything. Isaiah gives us no inclination to think otherwise here. No reason to think. But God's character is never called into question by the prophet, nor is God's sovereignty. It isn't assumed that it is assumed that God is in control of all things. But it's also assumed that God will prove wise once again. That in the end, we will see and we will understand why some of this played out the way it did. Right? The verse we just read there in verse 28, his understanding no one can fathom. Just because we can't understand it does not mean that there's not a good reason for it, right? That's what's so difficult for us to grasp. My children, you know, maybe I'm disciplining them. Maybe I'm taking something away from them. They don't like it. But I know a lot better than they do, don't I? I hope I do. Anyways, I'll sit there sometimes and I'll say, I'm 30 years older than you. Why can't you trust me? And you're just a little babe and you don't understand, you know, that you're going to hurt yourself or whatever it is. Is it not like that with us and God? Sometimes something's in our life that's extremely difficult. And we don't understand why is this going on and on, God. His understanding no one can fathom, Isaiah says. Maybe there's a reason. In Genesis 18:25, you'll remember this story of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? It's a really famous passage that sort of you hear a lot about in a bad way, usually. God rains down what's called fire and brimstone, and that's where that phrase comes from, I think, when we talk about hellfire, brimstone preachers and whatnot. That's, I think, where it comes from. There's this idea of God raining down his judgment, fire and brimstone, upon wicked, sinful people. Well, in that passage, it's really interesting. If you go back, Abraham, God tells him that he's going to do this, and that's where Lot lives. Lot is living near Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham's like, well, what are we going to do? Surely you're not going to rain down even on the righteous people, are you, God? Right? There's righteous and unrighteous. And he presents the problem to God, this dilemma. God, don't you see what's going on? And he kind of wrestles with God. If there's 50 people that are righteous, will you not spare them? Then he goes down, he ratchets it down a little bit. What about 45 and 40 and 30 and 20? And he goes all the way down to 10. And he kind of wondered, why didn't he keep going? He stops at 10. Maybe there wasn't any righteous. Because God does end up raining down fire and brimstone. But as he's wrestling with God, Abraham, what does he say? He says this to God in Genesis 18:25. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? What's the implied answer? Is, of course he will. Of course he will. And if that's what was right, God did it. Right? We rarely know why. It may not make a lot of sense to us. We can't get to the bottom of it. It's unfathomable, right? And something horrible happens and continues to happen, but that does not mean there is no wise and good purpose behind it. It doesn't mean that God's not up to something in some way that we just can't grasp. This is what Isaiah appeals to here in this passage. He says, I know God has not forgotten you. And I know that He sees you, and I know that it doesn't make much sense right now in the moment. But let us trust Him while we suffer. Let us trust the Maker of the heavens and of the earth. He must have a good reason. He will always do right. So God's infinite power is balanced. God's not this brutal tyrant throwing His power around, however, like what we think of here on earth. It's balanced and checked by the fact that God always does what is right and just and good. God may not use His power how we think He should, but that does not mean or does not impugn God's character in any way. And what's the result? What happens when we trust God in all of these things, even in our suffering and in our questions? This is our last point that we're going to look at here. We regain new strength and we find hope. Our last point is that God's power is used for the weak. Look at verses 29 through 31. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Isaiah says this to us this morning. The main thing in life is not your situation. It's where your trust lies. That's the main thing. Whom do you trust this morning? If you put your trust in earthly powers and authorities, in earthly structures or systems, in a church, in a pastor, in a spouse, in a child, in a economic system, in a leader, in a political structure, in peacetime, or in a military, or whatever, you will be disappointed. I promise. I'm going to disappoint you. I know that much. And you will be disappointed if you put your trust in anything but Almighty God. You'll be let down and you'll grow tired and you'll grow discouraged. If you not ever hope for something so badly, whatever it is, it could be big or small, but you hope for it, you hope for it, and you hope for it. Maybe it looks like it's going to happen and then it doesn't quite happen. It's discouraging. It's exhausting to live that way. But if your hope is in the Lord and if you wait upon the Lord, even in suffering and difficulty, you will renew your strength. This, of course, does not mean that you'll never be physically tired. So I'm not saying that, of course. It means that within your spirit, you will have a source of motivation and perseverance that will outlive your body. John chapter 4, I want to share this with you as we close. What did Jesus say to the woman at the well? What did He present her with? Jesus says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who's saying to you, give me a drink. This is a Samaritan woman out here drawing water out of this well. He walks up to her and he says, give me a drink. And she's like, what are you talking about? Like, this is not your well. Who are you? What are you doing here? And she kind of doesn't understand what he's getting at. But he says this, everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him shall never thirst. But the water I will give him will become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life. I don't think Jesus literally means here that you will never have times where you're thirsty in your life. I don't think that's literally what he's getting at, whether physical or spiritual. I think what Jesus is saying is that when you are thirsty, you don't have to despair. You can go to Jesus and be filled up. You can go to God and say, Lord, I'm thirsty today. Will you meet me? Will you fill me up? Will you give me yourself? And He will be faithful to do that. That's the message that Isaiah gives us today, is that because earthly powers fail us, doesn't mean that God's power will fail us. It's a very different thing. God is not like the earthly powers of the world. In the end, we can trust Him and we can surrender to His plan and will for our lives, even when we can't understand it fully. Amen.